I think it took away this myth that there was some big learning that you would just get and they would all click. When you're more junior, you think everyone's just so much smarter. And like, they do have experiences and those experiences stack. But you can really start to see when you're in a room of more senior people who's really good at what and who's really doing what. And the really good leaders weren't the ones that were talking about themselves. They were the ones that really figured out what they were good at and what they weren't.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, you might also like my personal newsletter. Each week, I share a lesson, a question, or an idea that I've picked up while learning from others. Subscribe at adaminseattle.com. On this episode, I got to talk with James Coyle. He's the CEO at RealSelf. They're a growing team of about 200 people that's raised $42 million. James previously had leadership roles at Amazon that took him all over the world. He talked about the value of great mentors, how he's learning to become a better listener, the unconventional career choices that have paid off, and his lessons on team building from doing thousands of interviews. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, James Coyle. Hey, James. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
So I heard a rumor that you take your employees out into the woods for meetings and they may or may not come back. Is that truly a practice that you have?
I think everyone's come back except for one. but yeah, it is a practice. And we do seem to indoctrinate people pretty quickly when they've joined our company recently. Our head of product has told me to probably calm down with inviting people a week or two into our company. But yes, it is something we do.
So what's the format for it? It's a hiking meeting or what's the format?
It is a hiking meeting and it's easy to just go out in the woods and talk about, you know, product plans and different customer problems we're trying to solve. And I think sometimes people, you know, let their guard down a little bit more when, you know, they're out in the woods versus a more formal meeting. And, you know, no one's taken too much pain from it because there's been quite a few repeats and also just a good way to get in shape. I think one of the things that we've all been battling with COVID and not seeing people in you know, in person is how do you find some ways to engage and something to get outside once a week or every couple of weeks and get to know people a little more closely and get back in shape because we're just sitting around all the time.
Yeah. What a great way to do it. Is that something that you started doing during the pandemic or was that a practice that you had established even before we were all locked down?
It's actually something I started at Varsity Tutors and I moved to Arizona for a couple of years and came back to Seattle. But hiking in Arizona, especially in the summer, is an interesting test for people. So Camelback was right by our office and every time software developers or the product team or different leaders, my boss at the time, Ian Clarkson, was a CrossFitter. And he used to do Ironmans as well. And so we just go and, you know, go for a 2-hour workout. And it always led to something, some interesting story. Someone always surprised you that was in way better shape or some people who sometimes didn't make it all the way. But again, people always asked to go and it's something to do that wasn't drinking. I think, you know, I think the older you get, the sort of less you want to go to a happy hour and the more you just want to get outside and get, you know, get some activity and do something different.
Is there any pressure against doing those 2-hour excursions into nature where you're busy CEO, you've got a full calendar? How do you keep space for doing that?
Do them early. It's a little bit harder right now this time of year here, but you try to get out early. We go out there at 6, you know, and we're going to be running back online at 9. Just try to fit in like anything else. You know, I was a pretty big golfer too, and it's really hard to fit around a golf in. Like just the older I get, the less I play. But if you got to do it, you got to do it early in the morning. Same with hiking. Really anything, honestly. Like any kind of hobby you try to do outside of your kids and work schedule.
Yeah. I love it. I'm also a recovering golfer, I think I maybe call myself almost a former golfer at this point of the amount I play. I don't know if I qualify to be a golfer.
We just did a 40. I just turned 40 and we did a abandoned dunes trip during COVID and the place was packed and I didn't realize that they don't have golf carts there. And so we crammed 5 rounds into 3 days and it was like a 40 to 45 mile walk. And yeah, it actually left me a little more sore than I'm, you know, probably proud to admit. So, but rare to get out a few days in a row.
We just got it on the record, so you did admit it that you have fatigue from golf.
It was walking though, and it was like 40 miles.
All right, we're going to dig into, I want to talk about like your path from big companies to startups and some of your learnings in Amazon, and now you're a CEO at RealSelf. I'm really been excited about this conversation because we've been connected for a little while. I wanted to just ask you first, like, how did you decide to make the move from bigger companies, Amazon and Sears, and wanting to get into startups?
You know, when you're in a company that has 500,000 employees, unless you're one of the, you know, most senior 5 or 10 people, you just always felt like a number, no matter how senior you were, at least for me. And you always had to follow whatever the sort of corporate guidelines for different things, from financial process, you know, budgets, all that kind of stuff. And I really wanted to see if it could go somewhere smaller and put a different structure in place and really be able to drive a culture myself. And I think I have a couple of examples now between VT and Varsity Tutors and RealSelf, where I think I've been a really instrumental part of coming in, and there was a culture there, and then, you know, changing it in a way that I wanted to change it. And that's something you really can't do at an Amazon or a place that's just that big, and you just don't own a big enough part of the company to do that.
Is that something you always wanted to do, or how did you come to that realization?
I think being at Amazon for 8 years, it sort of helped with that. I think there's some financial considerations too. You know, you can get a bigger ownership stake in a smaller company than you can in a bigger company. And I think you learn things at big companies and you learn things at small companies, and they're sort of all complementary to your sort of Rolodex of learning. And now, I never went back and got my MBA. One of my favorite bosses, you know, basically told me that I was already getting my MBA by being at Amazon. And I think he was right in a lot of ways. And so I had to find, you know, other ways to learn that weren't, you know, necessarily just going back to school. And I try to add something every year to the extent that I can, whether it's something functionally or something leadership wise. And the difference between the big and the small definitely added some different learnings that I probably wouldn't have gotten if I stayed at a bigger company.
Can you tell me more about the adding something every year? Is that a framework you have for your own improvement, or what's behind that?
You know, I think it's funny. I think the one big thing I took from Amazon is, and I think you probably take from going back and getting an MBA as well, is to have a framework for how you think about just about everything, you know, or a rubric for how you think about something. And I've had great mentors and bosses that have helped me think through those things. And between work and life, yeah, like I'd like to try to learn something new every year, something I try to instill in my kids, especially when I see them getting, you know, stale in terms of like only wanting to do one activity, et cetera. It's really easy for people to do the thing that they're good at. And I think as you get older, you know what your super strengths are and the ones that you don't have and the ones you need to find other people, which I think is one of the ways that I try to build teams. But I try to work on something that I think I'm weak at or that I want to learn. At work, it could be anything from a functional area, you know, going deep, like in marketing. I just took a Kellogg class, digital marketing, because I thought my marketing experience was stuck in 2009. Would be an example. Outside of work, I like to fix up old houses and can pretty much do everything inside of a house now. I'm not sure if I could build one from scratch. I'd probably come real close, but try to pick up, you know, a new thing every year, every other year, to the extent that I can, and become really good at it.
What's that process look like? How do you pick the thing? And then how deep do you go in terms of dabbling versus mastery? And what is your framework?
I think it depends if it's a life thing or a work thing. If it's a life thing, I think it tends to be largely driven by my wife or my kids, whether that's a sport or, you know, my wife will just grab a picture on house and say, hey, can you make this? And I'm like, not sure if I can. And then I try to figure out how to do it. We had a leak in our roof in our first house. I don't really want to pay someone $7,000 when I didn't have $7,000 in my bank account when I was in my early 20s. So cost me $2,000 to do it myself. So I did it myself. For work, this is the first time I've ever had a career coach. And they're really helpful at pointing out things that you're not good at. And I think their job is really to listen to you and find the trends and things that you want to work on or that you're struggling with. And I've actually found that process really helpful when identifying certain traits or things that I like to be better at. One of the most challenging ones in life is listening. It's one I work on a lot. Yeah, I think that's probably the first job at Amazon. I ran a call center in the Philippines from Seattle. And it was always shocking to me how you could have two people on the phone talking to each other and neither one was listening to the other. And then there was all these other like cultural affinity issues. Like, I don't understand why you're so upset that this $400 thing I can't afford is one day late. Like, you should just be thankful that you can buy that thing. And like, actually just contextually not understanding why. And, you know, I find the more senior I get, the more I can sit back and listen and watch other people not listening, just preparing themselves to speak versus thoughtful listening and then responding. That's been one of the big things I've been working on myself in the last year, especially when you come in to a startup, but not a new startup, and trying to identify what the problems are and where your leadership gaps are and stuff to try to go solve.
How do you go in that transition from listening to speak to listening to understand? That is a hard one. I've struggled with that personally. What's been helpful for you in going through that?
Yeah, I try to listen as long as I can. So I think when you're in a position, you've had really senior roles at startups too. I think sometimes you don't realize the weight you hold in a conversation. So when you speak, people sometimes just do what you say because you said it without actually knowing if it's the right thing to go do. And what I found being able to observe two other founders in the last few years was the impact that has on people and some of the problems it can cause. So I try to listen to everybody else first and speak at the end, you know, unless something is really egregious or just so obvious based on some pattern recognition that I've had in the past that I'm just like, okay, this isn't worth like, you know, waiting or letting the discussion go on. So I think it's nuanced and there's a bit of an art to it.
Yeah. How have you practiced it? Did that come naturally or did you have to create some kind of a check for yourself, or how do you integrate that into what you actually do?
I think you can read people. I think there's a lot of elements of, it's a little bit harder virtually probably than in person, but in person it's a lot easier to tell if you piss somebody off or not. Whereas I think virtually it's actually a little bit harder because you can't really read body language. And I guess I try to think about what I want in jobs and like what I've been the most, when I've been the best in jobs or when I've, you know, been empowered to do my job and succeed or fail based on the things I want to go do. And that's one of the things we really try to do at our company is when we interview people from Amazon, some of these other companies to come in and join us. One of the things we find a lot is that people don't feel empowered or like they could control their job. And we try to let people fail in the most controlled environment that we can. And I think as it comes to listening, I think you want to hear the thoughts and plans that people have. And you can tell when you interrupt people, and people will give you feedback. That's the other thing. I think the hardest thing about being the CEO of a company is like everybody's always looking at you. And, you know, what we've talked about this before on LinkedIn, anonymous feedback versus direct feedback. Mm-hmm. People are unafraid to give feedback. And, you know, you get it when you get those 30 pages of engagement survey, you know, results, and you're reading the text threads and you're just, ugh. And people don't forget stuff. If you really, you know, hurt someone's feelings or embarrassed them, it'll come out. And there's just no reason to be like that. I found like, you just don't, like, I was thinking about some of the questions you've asked me in the past and on Amazon, like the leadership principles are great. If you could take the good parts of Amazon, but not do the bad parts, like you can do a lot of really great things. And that's how we're trying to do things at Real Self.
Yeah. So can you say more about that? What are the, Amazon has these, they're pretty legendary, right? The leadership principles at this point.
Yeah.
And what are the things that, as you're now in the CEO seat, what are some of the things that you did take away from Amazon that you're trying to build into the culture or how you operate personally at Real Self?
Yeah. The driving results, diving into things analytically, really driving action versus talk. I think those three for me out of the 14 that they have are probably the biggest, along with being able to disagree with somebody and just being like, hey, it's okay that we disagree. And you kind of got to move forward, which is a little bit uncomfortable for people. But the bad parts, at least back in the day, I haven't been there for 7 years, is, you know, you get a bunch of type A personality people and, you know, there's just a lot of aggression and you see all the stories, people crying. I never really observed any of that, but you do observe a lot of turnover. You know, I can't remember the stats, but it was something like 45% of new hires didn't make it 2 years. This was back 2006, 2014. And it's just not a culture for everybody. And it's hard. Like people aren't always the nicest. And it's actually not that they're even being just really direct, and they just don't care about anything beyond results. Everybody is replaceable. And I think if you take the good part of that, the action part and the math-based, you know, frameworks and nothing ever being good enough, you gotta, always got to keep pushing harder and harder. Like, those things are all, you know, good, with a slightly more personable, you know, tone around them. And you really have a great place to work. And I think they've actually changed in some ways since I've left, based on some of the feedback that, you know, had come out from how hard it was to work there back in the day.
Is it possible then to have that like strong orientation toward results and action, and also have, I don't know what word you would use, but kindness? And you mentioned maybe people weren't always so nice. Is that a paradox, or have you been able to find a way to integrate those two things together?
You know, I worked with this guy named Ian Clarkson. He's the COO at VT. We worked together at Sears, worked together at Amazon. And he's really tough. Like, he's really smart, but he's really direct and really tough. And he's like, you can fire somebody and still be friends with them. But I think you can handle hard conversations in a respectful way. I actually think sometimes they become more awkward when you kind of let them fester and you actually don't have a direct conversation. So I think the thing you learn is that not everybody's right for different stages of the company. And sometimes there's not self-realization of that even for us. I sort of think I found like my niche of what kind of where I like to operate in. And I think people don't always believe that's true, but like, I found people who are really great from 0 to 10 and not great from 10 to 100. And then once they get big, like, really don't know what the hell to do because the conversations change. And I think if you're straight with somebody and direct and thoughtful, then yeah, you can. I mean, we've had people who've left Real Self that maybe didn't love the news when they left, but we also were like, hey, well, we're happy to help you find a job based on what we think, you know, you can really be a good fit. And most of those ended up being good relationships after. So yeah, I think you can.
Yeah, actually, remember you were at that time, you were reaching out, looking at sending them lists of jobs and helping people find their next thing. So yeah, you did follow through.
Yeah, well, like a lot of companies, we let some people go during COVID, and most of them have landed. And it wasn't a personal decision. It was based on all this crazy stuff that's happened in 2020.
Yeah. You were in management roles and senior roles at Amazon. This might be a dead end question, but I'm curious if the hard conversations look and feel different as the CEO at a smaller growing company versus the hard conversations you have in the middle of a big giant company.
Yeah, I think they're different. Amazon didn't have a hard and fast rule, like you had to fire 10% of the team, but there was a number that you had to have on a plan. And I think the challenge there was the number was arbitrary. And every year I felt like I put somebody on a PIP that I'm like, eh, they just haven't been here that long enough. But if I compare them to these other people, like the results, that's where you would put them in a forced stack rank. Whereas like, we don't have to have arbitrary forced curves and stuff like that, because we're just not dealing with a million people. And so I think you have a little bit less of the bureaucracy, and like, you have to do this because everybody has to do it. So I think like that's probably one of the main things that's different. Otherwise, yeah, there's an expectation if someone goes on a development plan at Amazon that they were not going to work at the company, you know, and that is different here at a smaller company. And you can have probably a more real conversation than you could there.
Since we're on the topic of Amazon, I wanted to learn a little bit more about why you went all around the globe and you took like different kinds of jobs. What was the genesis of that? How did that come about when you were taking all these different jobs in different geographies and kind of over the 8 years?
Dovetails to that learning comment. Like I graduated with a finance degree, and finance is a great, I would probably tell a lot of people if they were going to go get it. A business degree to get one in finance, or obviously computer science, how great engineers are doing. But Microsoft wouldn't let you switch functions very easily. So I went from Microsoft to Amazon with two leaders I knew from Microsoft to Amazon, great guys. And got calls one day, he's like, hey, I know you don't want to work in finance anymore. Do you want to go run a call center in the Philippines? I'm like, That's one of the more odd requests I've gotten. And he's like, you know, you did finance for an ops team. Like, go see if you can run the thing. And so I did. And I had to fly to the Philippines every other month for a couple of years from here. It was a crazy experience. And then from there, I wanted to go, I didn't want to be in ops at Amazon, and moving into the retail organization, there was really only one sort of job you could do, which is, you know, run inventory management for a retail category. So that's what I did. Had the best boss probably of my career. His name's Mike Frazzini. He's been there forever, 20-year Amazon guy. And the thing I loved about him was he's just the quickest damn dude you've ever met. Like, just mathematically, like, just super hyper, like, always on. I just admired his energy, because that's just not my, like, my operating style. And he's like, "Hey, you want my job?" I was like, "Well, like, someday." He's like, "You know, you could get it if you just move to Germany." He's like, the country manager for Germany is like, "We want to get some Americans to come over to Germany." And he's like, "I think you could do it," even though I hadn't run two of the functions and like the traditional category leader does at Amazon. And like, literally from the time he told me that I had an interview and I was in the country in 60 days. Like, it was just nuts. Like, I actually look back on it, it's so out of character for us, like, just how we like live life. And these guys come in, they just pack up your life, rent your house out, sell your cars, and you're just like,
you got to rewind on that a little bit, because you had kids, you're settled,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was like 2009. It was like, yo, put your kids in international school. It's actually a great age. Our kids were like 4 and 7. I just show up in Munich. I'm like this 29-year-old guy, and 29-year-old in Germany, they're usually 4 or 5 years out of school. Good education's free. And people thought I was like some like junior account manager. I was walking into these meetings, and all these gray haired guys, "Oh, who's the intern?" And it's, you get to tell them, "Actually, I run the business. Let's have a conversation." And it was fascinating. You come into a meeting, everyone's speaking German. They got the Americans here. So they like flip to English. But then when there was a meeting back with the Seattle guys, and all, because every week there's a weekly business review for the company, they always wanted the Americans to speak. There was two other expats came in, and because we spoke English, and they take up airtime, dude. And so it actually was great, because then Amazon was still in its infancy at that point, and we were all trying to figure out how this European thing worked, because we have all these different countries, and we have a team that works with each brand's team in each country. And we're like, how do we do this across Europe? And I got really lucky. I just negotiated this deal across all the countries with Sony. The guy that led Amazon Europe was in the meeting. We got close to $10 million or something like that in ad revenue. And he said, "Hey, why don't you come be my technical advisor," which is one of those jobs no one really understands what it is. And it's basically like the guy's business manager, but you just have to be in everything. And, you know, just super lucky. If I had to move to Luxembourg, I think if you could do that again, you wouldn't go from Munich to Luxembourg. It's just a step down. Like in every way, like living, it's more expensive. The town goes from 50,000 people on a weekend to 300,000 during the weekend, and then just goes back down. You know, Munich's this cosmopolitan, great place to live. But I went to Luxembourg, and after you do those jobs, you can go get a really great job off of that. And I mean, all the directors and VPs, which, you know, back in time was really hard levels to get at the company. You knew you were going to get it if you got one of those jobs. And I did. It was great. I got to be in all these meetings and hear stuff. And I think it took some of the luster off of what you think happens behind closed doors. Like the preparation and like, dude, how do these guys know everything? It's just like us too. Like, they're trying to figure it out. It's not like they know everything. But it demystified some of the stuff that I'm like, thought was maybe harder than it was, or like some people had in their head that I didn't. And everyone's struggling with the same things, you know. Do I have imposter syndrome? Am I like, do I really know what I'm doing? Like, these really complicated issues, like, that Amazon always solves, they don't always know the answer, and they test their ways into it, just like you do with a smaller company, but you just got to see it on a larger scale. It was fascinating. And then we can move back to the US after. But yeah, people always ask me, it's one of the most common questions I've gotten, because I've thankfully always looked fairly young. It's like, how do you have this job so young? And she's like, someone asked me to go do something, I'd always go do it, including moving. And I think some people just aren't that flexible. And I think it's one of the main reasons I was able to get ahead while I was there.
Yeah. Is that realization about, oh, they're just people, they're dealing with some of the same problems, how has that played out in your career going forward? How did having that realization change the way you think, or change the way you work, or decisions you made following that?
I think it took away this myth that there was some big learning that you would just get and they would all click. when you're more junior, you think everyone's just so much smarter. And like, they do have experiences and those experiences stack. But you can really start to see when you're in a room of more senior people, who's really good at what and who's really doing what. And the really good leaders weren't the ones that were talking about themselves. They were the ones that really figured out what they were good at and what they weren't. And I'm not a tech and product guy. I know it. And I'm probably not ever going to be. I can think through like a problem like a customer would, but like I know where the functionally I just need more help and don't understand. You know, just like in life, like I can do anything in the house, but mechanically when it comes to motorized things, like there's people who just get it and there's people who don't. And I've tried to get it and I actually just can't quite get it. Trying to build a go-kart right now. And like seems like it shouldn't be that hard, but it just is for some reason for me. But for some people, it gets really easy. And I think the older you get, you learn, hey, this is what I'm good at. I'm going to try to get better at some of these other things. And you also know who's really good at the things you're not. And I think the really smart people learn their sort of weak spots and gaps and try to fill them with others who solve them. And hopefully the most low ego way. Any team that I've seen at all those places that has died has always been about like ego in some way. And it's really hard to find low ego people in general. Like we all have one to some degree. It's just how big and can you get it out of the way?
Yeah. It sounds like you've been really intentional in building the team at Real Self based on some of those learnings. How have you done that? Like, how have you tested for that? And what's been the intention behind building this team? Because you've hired a bunch of people, leaders, all levels of the company since you've come in. So how has that played out the CEO role?
This feels like you've talked to Josh Siegel.
I got a little background, a few text messages.
I think the one benefit of Amazon is, I don't have access to obviously anymore, but I must have interviewed damn near 10,000 people during the 8 years I was there. I interviewed somebody every day, usually multiple times a day. And one of the benefits of that is they are someone that now thinks they know who you are, you know, because of that interaction. And one of the things that I think has been really interesting over the years is how bad companies are. Don't hire somebody, actually telling them why. And there's been a bunch of people who reach out to us all the time. We have conversations with, and we try to be really upfront and say, this is what we're looking for. You may or may not fit that. Right. And if you don't fit that, like we're going to tell you, we're going to tell you why. And, you know, a couple of people I've tried to hire at different companies and that I really wanted to hire, but just wasn't right at the time. And so like, I think you see all these horror stories of people coming into a place and not being what, you know, it was sold to them. And I think we've all probably experienced that at some point. So we try to be really upfront with people. This is where we're at. This is what we're trying to do. And this is what we need. And as far as being intentional about our team, when you're a startup, you never really know what you're going to get when you come, especially when you come into something. And, you know, I think Amazon really, and Varsity Tutors too, because we hired 800 people in 3 years, crazy number like that. Just assess the talent we have and the gaps we have. And I think it's easy to move some leaders out, but rehiring them more slowly back in has been the approach I've taken. So we've added a new, you know, VP or C-level executive, I would say every 2 to 3 months. And we really like the team that we have right now. And we're pretty simple. We like people who are smart. We like people who want to go and solve consumer problems. And we really want to like who we work with. And that's a really hard mix to find. But we've all had people that we didn't like working with. And those are sometimes really unsolvable things. And so our networks are pretty deep. And we've been able to hire probably 40 people through first and secondary connections from the 4 or 5 of us that kind of, you know, form the most senior leaders in the company. And we've been able to find like-minded people, really smart, really motivated. And I think it's been easy to find great people who've had bad experiences other places. And we're really trying to build something different.
This might sound like a simpleton question, but why is it important to like the people on your team? And what does that actually look and feel like when you like each other?
I think it looks like you can have harder conversations, for one. So I think you don't, like, I don't worry about hurting somebody's feelings in our leadership team right now. Something's not working or something's not going fast enough. I think I can tell you how you know it's not right. When you're not looking forward to going into a meeting, or you're not looking forward to going into a one-on-one, you're at a point, whether that's a performance related issue or just stylistically you don't work, like it's just hard to hard to solve those things sometimes. And sometimes people just aren't a great fit. We always talk about, is the company a great fit or is the job a great fit? But like, the hardest damn thing about any of these jobs is working with other people. Like, it's not working in on the React platform or LaunchDarkly or whatever, you know, whatever tool or system or customer, you know, it's just, it's working with other people that's hard and taxing. And, you know, we talk about super strengths, and I think one of mine has been being able to build really good teams over time. And I stay pretty well connected with most of the teams I've had in my career. And some of them I'm never going to work with again because they became as senior or more senior than me. And it's awesome. Like, I've hired a ton of people where I'm like, man, that guy is way smarter than me. And it should be scary, but I'm not scared. And I think Amazon kind of got you over that hump. Some people at that company were so much smarter than me. And I see some of the kids that come out of undergrad now, and I feel like they're so much smarter than we were technically coming out of undergrad 20 years ago. And I think it's being okay. It's awesome to see other people being just as successful. And you can tell when people come back and want to work with you a second time or come to you for advice that you're doing some of the right things.
I like that. Yeah, we spend so much time at work getting along, liking each other. I like your use of inversion there of just what it doesn't look like, because we've all had those moments where you like don't want to go to the one-on-one.
Yeah. And I think we've all held on to some of those employees longer than we should, whether that's, you know, for your company or they need a different role. It's obviously there's different outcomes. People just aren't a great fit. I don't think it's anything to be upset about. I think it's actually something to be more real about sooner. Because it's a big deal. Like, I think it actually creates a lot of health problems too. Like, you know, when you're really stressed, you can feel your health like not being great. And a lot of it can be work stress, can be people stress, and trying to figure out what yours is and can you solve it. It's just an important thing in life.
Right. Your whole posture of how you're going on about your day and your meetings and everything you're doing kind of changes when you're in that,
totally,
in that state, right?
Totally.
So I got one more Amazon question before I leave you, because I've been very curious about this. Can you educate me on the six pager thing? I don't know if it's a process, a framework, a tool. What is the six pager?
Yeah, it's funny. So I went from Microsoft to Amazon, and Microsoft was like PowerPoint hell. Like, I still have nightmares of my last year of finance. Like, they had these mid-year reviews, and like, we would hire McKinsey to put the decks together. And literally, it's everything that you're taught not to do. It's sort of 10, 20, 30 rule. That's not what Microsoft would do. They would put like 5,000 words, and they would just make the page bigger. So it was like an 11 by 17 page. And you go to Amazon, and they don't use PowerPoint. Like, they just don't use it. And so the first couple of meetings I had, they're like, can you write a six-page narrative? And they give you like a template. And like some examples. But the first time you do it, it really sucks. It's just that maybe you're a great writer. Like, I'm still not a perfectly great writer. Like, we have people at our company who are just fantastic. But you can't bullshit in a Word document. Like, you have to expound upon your thoughts. And so you'll write this thing, and then you go back and read it, and you're like, shit, that's not what I wanted. Like, that's not what I wanted to get out. The real deal is that most meetings are that six-page format. And they'll usually give you a template. Like, the only exception is this weekly review the whole company goes, which is just like a 200, I assume it's the same, it was like a 200 slide set of numbers, like tables of numbers. And if your numbers are red in your category, you got to speak. But the narrative, you got to get all your thoughts on paper, expound your thinking. Many people can present a deck, but not really know the details of their business. Back in the day, Jeff B would actually be in meetings, and he slowly came out. And then Jeff Wilkie would be in meetings, and he slowly moved up. And he just kept pushing that framework down. And it was just amazing. Like, when you wrote everything out, like the questions that they would ask and like the things that they would find in your business. I always left a meeting like, man, how the heck does that guy have the pattern recognition to call out something that I just never would have seen or guessed? And since I left, we tried doing them at Sears. They didn't work particularly well. But at VT, we were mostly ex-Amazon. We do them here at RealSoft as well. Some people don't like it. Like, I think when you have board meetings, I think sometimes boards aren't used to writing or like reading narratives with that kind of depth. But I found it immensely helpful. Like, I I find I do it in my personal life. If I'm making a big decision, like I'll actually write out the pros and cons in a narrative. And the really good writers, they can really get their points across in a really specific way when you do it right.
Is it used as a decision-making tool, or is it used even more broadly than that?
It's probably both. If you're going to go try to go, you know, start a new business or category, like, yeah, mm-hmm. the expectation is you have to go do the work and ask for funding and all that. And there's a big, heavy emphasis on Amazon during the planning cycle. But every month you had to send an update on your business. And we were running billion-dollar categories. Mm-hmm. And then once a quarter, you had to review deeply, are you on track for your plan? And I think the biggest thing that it taught me was to just be open about the things that were good and bad. I think people are always quick to talk all out the good. But the bad is where you learn, or the misses are where you learn. And it taught me it was okay to have misses. I mean, I remember, I'll never forget it. I got promoted this one year, my second year at Amazon, from level 6 to level 11. And I thought I was going to get not meets, because I think I had 7 goals and I think I missed 3 of them. And I got an outstanding review, and I wrote mine as achieved, and I didn't feel great about it. And I remember sitting down, and the boss hands me the write-up and stock grant, and he's like, oh, you had an outstanding year. And I was 2 layers below that on my self-evaluation, because missed 3 out of 7, 4 out of 7 is an F. And they're like, yeah, but your goals are really aggressive, and you made progress on all of them. And that's probably some the softer side of it. Like, whereas you hear people crying, like, I never cried. I never saw anybody cry. But there was probably one of the times where I'm like, oh, it's not like you got to hit all these things, like you're fired kind of thing.
You're setting the high bar, but there's a mindset of learning from the misses, and you don't need to check every box when you're reaching that.
Yeah, they had this section that was always called airing your dirty laundry. You know,
that's in the 6-pager.
It was always in. There was always these questions at the end, and it's what's your? I think that's how they phrased it. Like, you're airing your dirty laundry, or sort of like the dog's not barking was another way that they would phrase it. So obviously things keep you up at night, that kind of thing. And if you wrote something soft, they'd be like, okay, you have this $3 billion business, and there's nothing that's bothering you, or that could be better. If you went in with a non-humble view. And I guess if I could articulate it well, I was a really cocky kid, like in my early 20s, and like the place like just humbles you, like in a good way. Like, it's, yeah, you know what, there's 30,000 other people who are just as smart as you, and you need to get in gear and be awesome. And for me, like, I left there thrilled where I went, but I would say humbled in so many ways that I'm appreciative of now. I probably wasn't at the time, to be honest.
I don't want to go work in a big company where there's 30,000 people smarter than me. I think that sounds horrifying. Yeah. You have to take your ego down. All right, James, this has been awesome. I love learning from you on this. I want to wrap up with the Supersonic 6, the rapid fire round. So, number one, how much coffee do you drink?
Oh, I'm ashamed to say. 5 to 6 espressos a day.
That's strong. No wonder you can hike for so many hours at 6 a.m.
My wife's the same. It's probably not good.
Number two, what's one other Seattle company that you're following or studying right now?
I'm curious about Flex. You got some really good leaders, some ex-Amazon guys, some ex-Quantum guys. I think I was going to say Convoy, but I think both of those two, I think, are really interesting right now.
Number three, who's one Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
Love Barton. So Rich Barton's one of our main investors. I think watching him come back from being chairman to CEO, and how they've really flipped Zillow's business model the last couple of years. He's got a bunch of ex-Amazon guys on their finance team, but continues to reinvent that business, and they're doing really well. He's a super charismatic guy and a really great speaker. I was super fortunate to be able to get to interview with them when I took this job.
Number four, what's one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
Ooh, that's probably two. I think there's a lot of great leaders in the company, or sorry, in the city. I think figuring out ways to have more remote first companies to take advantage of some of those leaders, I think, would be one. And I think the second is the business, the city is getting more business unfriendly. things like the new payroll tax, you know, adding 1.7 to 2.4% the payroll expense to companies that are sitting inside the city is just not a great way to get businesses to come into a place that already has a high cost of living. So I think you're going to see more companies go out to the burbs. Seattle can't figure out a way to make it cheaper for companies to operate inside the city.
Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self? I think that's 20 years ago now.
Yeah, don't be such an asshole. Right, would probably be one, but probably just be less aggressive. I think I was almost too aggressive at that age, and I think that there's more than one way to get from point A to point B. And I think back then it was only a straight line, and I didn't really care who was in the way of the straight line. And I think now you learn that there's a number of different ways to get there that you just don't know when you're in your 20s.
I like that. Kind of ties together a lot of the things you were talking about earlier, which I love. Number six, what can this community do to help you? Do you have any call to action for listeners, any job posts or events or things you want people to go take a look at?
First, thanks for what you do. I think you've definitely found a way to connect a lot of us together throughout the city, which is really cool. And I just wanted to say thank you for that. And we do have a lot of roles. So we've hired 30 people in the last 90 days. We're going to add another 100 people in the next 12 months. So yeah, any help finding engineers, product managers, digital marketers, salespeople, it would be super helpful for us. We're gearing up for a really big year. Our traffic's up a couple 100%, and we've got some pretty big, bold plans that we want to execute on in the next few years.
Awesome. So if people like the sounds of your style and what you got going on, where should they go? What's the best place to go see what jobs are open?
You can go to realsup.com/careers, or you just reach out to us directly. We're a pretty low-key group. Company's not that big. So all of us are more than happy to take calls and get to know people.
All right. If anybody wants an intro, let me know. And James, thank you so much. It's been great talking with you.
Yeah, thanks, Adam.
Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.